WBAI.org online. Stay tuned for Off the Hook coming up in the next hour. And as always, if you appreciate what we bring to the table on a daily basis, please consider becoming a financial supporter to this radio station by calling 212-209-2950 or go to give to WBAI.org online. Stay tuned for Off the Hook. It is 7 p.m.
Hello, you're listening to WBAI in New York. It's just about 7 o'clock on a Wednesday evening, and that means it's time for Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. But if they could, they would. So Billy Bones was the best to say the words. I hope that's understood. But Billy Bones.
Program is Off the Hook, and for some reason we're massively distorted. If somebody could maybe fix that. Yeah, this is Emmanuel here on are we okay? Kyle over there, how do you
hey, what's up?
You sound much better than I do for some reason.
I've been told that.
Okay. And in Skype land we have Rob P. Firefly.
Good evening.
We have Gila.
Good evening.
And we have Alex. Alex, are you on a train? Alex, you're moving your mouth, but no sound is coming out. And you're still doing it. does sound not work on trains? Is that the problem here? Okay, this is silly. he's talking, but can you hear me, Alex? Nod your head if you can hear me. All right, we can't hear you, so you have to figure out how to make your microphone work. And while everybody in New York waits, you have to get your microphone to work.
How fast is that train going?
I don't know. Faster than the speed of sound, apparently.
Faster, way faster.
Yeah. Okay, so we have a backup plan in case this doesn't work. We can call him on the phone.
Oh, of course.
All right. See, now you're distorted. Yeah. Well, folks... Alex, any progress? Because this is not helpful for a radio audience to have somebody who we can't hear.
Okay, well, now you're muted on Skype. You weren't before, I don't think.
All right, are you able to see this, Rob? Are you able to see what the problem is?
I'm able to see the mute icon showing that his Skype is muted from his end.
Okay, so that tells
and
me he tried
now
to...
he's put the phone down.
He tried to unmute himself, and in so doing, double-muted himself. Okay, well, let's get him on the phone then. If we can't get him on.
Yeah. I'll go ahead and work on that.
Okay. Let's see. What are we supposed to? Yeah, he's holding his finger up. But you have a solution, Alex? Okay, I don't know how we're supposed to communicate this way. This is insane.
Maybe he's getting him to stop the train.
Well, Alex, if you get out of the quiet car, that might help.
Maybe that's the case. Maybe he's in a car, he's not able to speak. Yeah, let's get him on the phone. That's our solution here. Okay, so we have, let me just launch into, we're in the final, actually we extended our EFF fundraiser for the Hope Conference up until this coming Friday. So that means that if you want to support the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who basically are responsible for any remaining rights that we might have on the Internet and in the digital world, you can do two things at once. You can go to the Hope Conference and support EFF, as we're donating 10% of every ticket sold up until the end of this week, up until the end of Friday. So go to hope.net. There's more details there. Normally that runs through the month of April. We decided to extend it another week because we're terrible at promotion and we just weren't promoting it nearly enough. But I think now we hopefully we'll get more people involved. And also, you know, speaking of, I hear sound. Is that
good? Yeah, I believe Alex is now rejoining us audio only, or he is back with both audio and video and it's working.
Okay.
All right, so you guys
there you are. There you are. You know, someday we've got to test these things before the show. Okay, so...
What would the fun be in that?
Yeah, no fun at all. I'm sure our listeners would agree. So anyway, just finishing up here, for people who want to get involved in the conference as far as giving talks, we're still accepting speaker submissions. We're still accepting workshop submissions. For those who don't know, the Hacking on Planet Earth conference takes place July 22nd through 24th. At the campus of St. John's University. It's going to be an amazing hacker gathering, and there's all kinds of ways to participate, to be a part of that. So all the details, again, at hope.net. We've been tearing our hair out organizing things, and it's going to be a lot of fun. All right, so let me just say at the start of the show, because the Supreme Court material that you might have heard about was leaked illegally, we're not allowed to talk about it. So we have to skip that subject.
You're joking. That's not true, is it?
No, imagine if that were true. but I see people nodding and saying, okay, I'll comply. No, don't do that. Don't do that. That's wrong. we're sometimes told things that are basically false, given rules that don't make sense. And you always have to question. You always have to question when you're told certain things. So, yes, of course we can talk about the leak of the Supreme Court decision about Roe versus Wade. And how unprecedented such a thing must be. Alex, as a lawyer yourself, you must be blown away by living in a time where the Supreme Court is basically being dismantled by being shown to be an organization of political hacks. I mean, I don't want to be too harsh there, but I think that's pretty accurate right now. Alex, are you there? Now he's frozen. This is ridiculous. It's just the 21st century here, and we can't make a... Okay, can we just get him on the phone already, please, Kyle? Thank you. Yeah. we had better connectivity in the 80s, I think. How about Rob and Gila? How about you take this?
Okay, well, out of the two of us, I think I should be the one to speak about this. So, no, go ahead, please.
Oh my goodness. Angry is not even the word does not even begin to cover it. I was saying to someone this morning, I've just kind of existed at a state of low-grade nausea for the last couple of days. And I am curious what the end game of this leak is. And there are so many things that could happen because of it, but wondering where and why and how and what it means. And ultimately, I find myself less concerned with the mechanics of the leak than I am with its contents. And as a person with a uterus, I am utterly terrified. Even as a person living in a state where reproductive rights have been enshrined in state law, as a person with a uterus, I am terrified. And I could keep repeating that I am terrified. So if anybody has anything that's more productive, I'd be happy to hear that too.
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's been a lot of activity, obviously, on Twitter about this particular subject. I had some interesting conversations when this was taking place on Monday night. And the thing that bugged me, I was basically, you know, upset like everybody was. And one of the comments I made was, you know, what might change this is a million people on the street. And overwhelmingly, I was lambasted for saying such a thing. No, that won't do any good at all. We tried that. It didn't work. Everybody is so jaded, so cynical. They just assume that, no, you can't do anything about it. It's done. And I was getting the same reaction from people who are on the right, who supported what the Supreme Court is about to do, and also from people on the left who bitterly opposed it. Now, you know, for the latter, I think it's just really, really sad when we have convinced ourselves that our voices don't matter, that we can't make any change by being out there. Let me tell you, a million people in the street, every day, constantly, loudly, for a decision that has not actually officially been made yet. And I have to think back at things like, you know, the Vietnam War, the Arab Spring, the fall of the Iron Curtain, and that wasn't done by legislation. That was done by people power. And we have to start realizing that we have power as people and stop assuming that it's all lost. Yeah, it sucks. It's you know, a terrible situation we're in right now. But we can't give up. We can't say, you know, I've seen people say things like, you know, we have the House, we have the Senate, we have the presidency, and we still can't do anything, so I'm not going to vote anymore. You know, you might as well just go out there and throw your support in for the right wing. You just might as well do that, because that is exactly the result you get when you give up like this. Look, you don't take steps all at once. You take many steps. And right now, we're taking very tiny steps because it's a very tiny majority. You need to make a bigger majority if you want to take bigger steps. If you give up and say, I didn't get it all at once, guess what? You go backwards. And the people you're opposed to, they're the ones who make the decisions. So, you know, I don't think it's a choice. I don't think it's a choice between being in the streets and voting. No, you do both. And if you're in the streets and things don't change, well, they're not supposed to change immediately. It takes time. It takes a lot of journeys to the streets. It takes a lot of elections, too, sometimes. But we have to be not only patient, but forceful and driven. And I just fear that we're losing that and turning on each other. And that's totally the wrong way, and it's exactly what the other side wants. And I understand we have Alex on the phone now. Is that right, Alex?
Yeah, can you guys hear me now?
Yeah. How about, why did we do it this way to start with? We don't need to see you. I mean, you know, it's great to see you, but we don't need to see you.
Well, I agree with that. But then again, you know, where would the fun be in, you know, working all these kinks out ahead of time?
What are you doing on a train?
I am heading back from D.C. Actually, at an event that my firm hosted entitled Pack the Capitol, which was pretty cool. And we had hosted a bunch of members of Congress and their staff and talked about, you know, ICS, SCADA, and critical infrastructure related issues. Great set of speakers, I think so. But that's neither here nor there. I think we're talking about this Roe v. Wade draft decision, and I want to bounce off some of the things that you had said, Emmanuel, with regard to whether or not we can still make a difference here. And I think that ultimately the intention behind the leak of this draft will determine whether or not we can make a decision with respect to the, I'm sorry, make an impact with regard to the actual terms of this decision. Because this is such an unusual thing to happen from any court. I mean, I started out my legal career a long time ago in D.C. as a federal appellate law clerk. So at a court that was one level below the Supreme Court. I wasn't a law clerk at the U.S. Supreme Court, but I was a law clerk for the chief judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. We were essentially the Supreme Court of the military. And the idea that any one of the law clerks for the judge, essentially you write the opinions for the judge, their orders, you prepare a bench memoranda, you confer with them, about how they should decide a case. It's the closest you can ever come to being a federal judge without actually being a federal judge, being appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. So it's a pretty cool job to have right out of law school. They're very coveted. And you're right at the beginning of your career. So it would be really, really unusual for a law clerk at the Supreme Court to leak this type of document. Although it may very well have come from a clerk and possibly from a conservative clerk, because the court likes to pride itself on being completely insulated from political vicissitudes and the political process. And that's one of the reasons why they have these life appointments. But leaking this document and then exerting a great amount of political pressure, either through protest or through Congress, if that does affect the court now, then that's some kind of acknowledgement that the court is not above these processes and is not insulated from it. And so the idea of leaking this document, leaking the draft, well after it was prepared in apparently February and well before it would be issued, which would be in June, could be to socialize the notion of Roe v. Wade being overruled in this country so that it doesn't come as a massive shock in June. And it allows the court now to essentially thumb its nose at all of us protesting about these rights because they're the ones with the ultimate say on the issue.
Mm-hmm. Why would a conservative do it, though?
Well, a conservative would do it, and I apologize for the background noise here. If anybody's on Acela 2126 to New York, come say hello in the cafe car.
I don't know why you'd advertise that, but maybe you can move away from the lab math that you're near, because there's somebody there that doesn't have an off.
He's probably coming in better than I am, I would imagine. But so why would a conservative clerk leak this? Precisely because now that the opinion and the contours of the opinion are in the public domain, if the court were to change course, it would seem like it would that the court was then being influenced by outside forces. So by leaking it now, in a form that is very palatable and very pleasing to conservatives, could essentially lock in that language. It could mean that now there is not going to be any change because any further change would acknowledge that change can come from without as opposed to within the court.
Interesting. Okay, I see what you're saying. So of course, it is a draft, so it's supposed to change. It's expected to change. But you're saying if it does change, the conservatives will latch upon that and say, aha, that's proof that the court has been politicized.
Yeah, absolutely. And the court itself doesn't want to make any kind of action that would acknowledge the fact that they are responding to protests or responding to the calls of the population because they are supposed to be above that. That's the whole point of having Article III federal courts in the Constitution with judges that have lifetime appointments, is that they are not subject to the political vicissitudes, to the whims of the people. They are looking after the long-term interests of the country and the people. But the other thing that I think has been missed a lot in the mainstream media, and I think that we should talk a little bit about and off the hook because it's important to our listeners and important to the hacker community, is that Roe v. Wade, of course, it's a case that's about abortion, but fundamentally, it is a case about privacy. Roe v. Wade was decided on the basis of the 14th Amendment affording a zone of privacy, that the fundamental and personal rights that flowed down from the Constitution through the 14th Amendment to the states, created this zone of privacy within which a woman had a right to choose, especially during the first trimester, whether or not she was going to carry a pregnancy, carry a child to birth, or to terminate it through an abortion. And so this is about a fundamental right to privacy, and destroying the fundamental right to privacy could have a real knock-on effect to the right of privacy itself.
I say so. That could be an effect on all sorts of other things that we take for granted as well. This doesn't necessarily stop with the issue of abortion. I'll assume you're agreeing with me, as you've probably lost signal. Maybe
it seems like a real originalist sort of thing, where it's a lot of the language around it is that this isn't explicitly mentioned in the Constitution, therefore there's no guarantee of it enshrined at a base level of our system, of our constitutional documents and ideology.
Well, we have an interesting story that was basically forwarded to us. A location data broker known as SafeGraph has stopped offering data related to Planned Parenthood and other similar family planning centers after Vice Motherboard found it was possible to buy information on how many people were visiting the facilities, where they came from, and where they went afterwards, something that experts saw as highly concerning in the wake of the Supreme Court's potential plan to repeal Roe v. Wade. SafeGraph's response last night shows that location data brokers do and can make decisions about what specific sets of data to make available for purchase. In light of potential federal changes in family planning access, we're removing patterns data for locations classified as NAICS code 621410, family planning centers. Wow, they have a code. From our self-serve shop and API to curtail any potential misuse of its data. That was from SafeGraph's CEO, who wrote that in a blog post that was published earlier today. Now, SafeGraph sells access to several different types of data. They include information on where businesses or other points of interest are physically located in the world, aggregated transaction data on how much money people spend at them, and aggregated location data showing where groups of people who visited these points of interest came from on a census block level and what other businesses they went to afterwards. That last set of data is based on location information harvested from ordinary apps installed on people's smartphones. This is scary. This is really scary. It's good that they disabled this, but it's scary nonetheless that this is even possible. Do we have Alex back?
Yeah.
Alex, are you there? No, he's not there. Okay.
Yeah, I'm here, but it's very, very faint. Your audio coming into to me is really low.
Okay, well.
So it's a little bit hard to hear.
It's hard to hear because the guy was broadcasting his entire life to the whole train.
Oh, my God.
Can you move to another part of the car or a different car or between cars or on top of the train or something?
I'm trying. I'm telling you, this guy is...
You know what,
Alex?
Go into the... Yeah, well, you don't have to be next to him. Go to the bathroom. Those are great places to have conversations.
That's not a bad idea.
Yeah, yeah. And they're nice and big, too, on the Acellas.
Yeah, that's true. They are, though. Not necessarily wide, I think. In fact, that's fine. This restroom's out of service, if you can believe that. Okay. I'll be back.
All right. Rob, you forwarded the story to us, so any thoughts or comments on it?
Well, it was interesting watching this develop because just yesterday there was the story that broke on Vice Motherboard about this company and the fact that they were making this information available to anyone who wanted to buy it and the extent of the information. And the next day, the same site published that this company was no longer going to be selling that data. And, of course, it's now a sensitive subject. Now it's in the public consciousness. But they were doing this for how long? They were doing this basically unregulated for how long? And... I think it really spotlights a problem that a lot of people don't think often about, which is the fact that the phone in your pocket tracks everywhere you go by default. And you can't always control with whom this information is being shared. You can turn off location in your phone settings if you care to dig down that deep, or you can install a fake GPS app, which can be a lot of fun to play with that will claim you're wherever you want to be. But at the end of the day, this information is being gathered, it's being logged, it's basically being made available to anyone who wants to use it for or against the general public. And that's a big problem with the data environment as it stands.
Yeah, I think the only way to really stop this is to just turn your phone off, right?
Yeah, I mean, you could turn off GPS tracking in your phone. But it does cost you a lot of utility. A lot of people use their phones to find directions to places or find things nearby or whatever, and you do lose that when your phone isn't using the location functionality. Also, not all phones make it easy to disable that. It depends on what you're using, what phone, and what make and model. But it's one of the many things that has kind of been accepted as a modern convenience, but which can come at a great cost. And in the case of this company, they were tracking people who went to a family planning facility, say, or a place where abortions were being made available, and then tracked where those people went after that. And obviously many of these people would go home. And that information being made available to the wrong sort of people can be a threat, in fact, an actual physical threat to the safety of someone who had to use a service like that. So this is this should not stop here. The discussion should not stop because this company said, oh, we won't sell this anymore. This should only be the tip of the iceberg in really reexamining the operations that deal in this information, but also the fact of the software that gathers this information by default. This could be an app on your phone that does something completely unrelated to location that decides it wants to track your location. You know, there have been flashlight apps that track your location and send it to who knows what because the app makers make money selling that data, and that data gets sold on and gets gathered by firms like this who sell it to anyone.
Now, you say firms like this. This isn't the only firm that does this, right? There could be this one turned it off. This one stopped collecting that data or sharing that data. But how many others are out there?
I couldn't even begin to speculate, but it is a big business. It is just part of the complete the huge business there is. There are tons of money to be made in metadata, in information about individual people. That's where you go, what you buy, what you like, what you talk about. And all of this is being gathered, and all of this can be made available to somebody who just has the money for it. And in cases like this, it is not only an invasion of privacy, it is a real threat.
And it's not just happening in this sort of way, because we have this motherboard article open on the screen in front of us. So I clicked over on another link about the CDC buying data to make sure people were locking down effectively for COVID. The CDC buying tons of data to track specifically monitoring the effectiveness of policy in the Navajo Nation because they could, because it was there. And I will say that John Oliver did a thing on metadata harvesting and the kinds of things you can do with it a couple of weeks ago on The Daily Show. Not The Daily Show, excuse me. Last Week Tonight. It was fantastic. It was insightful. And I think it is probably going to help reach a lot of people who might not understand this sort of situation otherwise.
I think it has a lot to do with the workaround, the sort of ad-fueled innovation life cycles we've lived through with many companies offering free services but finding that this is a way to make money without charging people. And the other benefit is a lot of the pressures on intelligence and surveillance and privacy has forced greater scrutiny to the government, and they then, in turn, much like with bug bounties, created this whole ecosystem of
private entities that are already being used in the ad networks. They're already there, so they're gathering information. So why not have government and other entities that are ostensibly barred in officially collecting and gathering and organizing in some regards, not all regards, though, of course. But rather, they find there's plenty in the private marketplace they can buy just as easily as someone who is building an app around this kind of data or ad network.
But the other thing is, this isn't new. And I remember, and this also relates back to a bunch of the pregnancy stuff that we've been talking about, because there are people, there was an article I remember reading, this, Kyle, you pinged it in my mind, 10 years ago. The headline was how Target knew a girl was pregnant before her dad did because she used a credit card to buy a pregnancy test. And they were like, oh, so they started sending coupons for baby formula to this house. And there are stories of women who have – people who have been pregnant and then who weren't pregnant anymore but had been pregnant and were getting stuff about, hey, your kid must be old enough to start kindergarten. Here are ads for backpacks. And this can become insidious, and it's not just about privacy, but it can also become about, like, the mental health of people and the tracking that happens and the ways that we use the data and what it means to be not just a data point but a person and where the two meld, I suppose. And that's obviously something that we deal with a lot here, is where the line is.
Yeah, I think it's important, really, to always think like a hacker in all these scenarios. With regards to being tracked by advertisements, like Gil just mentioned, you don't always have to be you. online. You don't always have to have your real name. You don't have to have your real address. I know it can be a hassle sometimes keeping track, but it can also be fun, and you can confuse these systems that are there to track you, and you can learn something about it as well. It's easy when you do this on a regular basis, and you don't become as much of a victim.
Yeah, I like to have a couple of good fake birthdays.
Yeah, exactly.
I know other people that do too.
Uh huh.
It's great.
Yeah, why should Facebook be the arbiter of all that?
You know what? I care so much about them. I'm not going to say what they are, but I know what they are, and I think it's fun.
Uh huh. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, just basically, any way that you are tracked. For instance, we were talking about the cell phones, how you want to use GPS if you have navigation. If you want to get somewhere, obviously you need the GPS to be on. Well, maybe somebody could write a utility where basically if you request that particular application, it automatically turns on GPS, and then when you arrive at your destination, turns it off. You know, so that you don't have to always be the one to worry about enabling it and disabling it, figuring out how to enable it or disable it in the first place on your phone. If these can be things that are easy to use and desirable, I think we'll be able to strike a blow for defending our privacy to an extent. And, you know, as far as thinking like a hacker, there is, with this particular story that we're focusing on right now, there are so many ways to do that, to thwart the system, to figure out ways to outsmart it. I know that in many cases, abortion pills are what people use rather than actually having abortions. So, you know, I was wondering, so are they going to make sending abortion pills to somebody who wants an abortion, that's a crime? Okay, well, then what if you send an abortion pill to somebody who isn't even pregnant? Is that a crime? What if everybody was given abortion pills in advance so he could just have them? That way everyone has what they need, and it's a silly scenario, but you have to think differently and outsmart the system, because it's stupid legislation, it's backwards thinking, and we're better than this. Go ahead, Rob.
And you mentioned why can't this be easy to do, to just set it up in some way that protects you by default? And the answer to that is because it is incentivized on behalf of the people who make their money this way. They have an incentive to make it difficult for you. All of us know when say news articles started giving you the cookie warning screens before you read that say, you know, this site uses cookies for this, that, and the other, and you can accept all by clicking one button. But if you want to make any sort of other decision, you have to click through a menu, click through a bunch of switches, click through something else, and then you can read your damn news article. And it is made so difficult to assert your rights, basically, that they're expecting people to just leave it, let it go, and you give up that much more of your privacy. And that's what this is all about. It's about privacy. Alex had mentioned, and I think Gila as well, that this Supreme Court issue, this Roe versus Wade issue, is about privacy. And you had mentioned this too, Emmanuel. And it will not stop at Roe versus Wade. The medical privacy issue affects trans people. It affects all sorts of people who need certain protections will not be given to them, that can then be denied them under the law. And this is the beginning of a very scary, very slippery slope. And
fortunately, there's not very much in the way of anti-trans or anti-gay legislation, right?
Right.
I haven't read a newspaper in a few months. Oh, Lord, what are we facing? Do we have Alex? Is Alex on the phone or is he on Skype?
He's all over.
Alex has sent a chat message that says he's out of the tunnel the train was going through, so if you want to ring him again, you can get him back.
So he's not connected. Okay. You know, we should have a light. We should have a light that lights up when we pick up the phone. So, Kyle, you able to reconnect to him? Well, you're next to the phone. It's logical. All right. Soon we'll be hearing from Alex again. This train ride has been so disruptive. Alex, you there? No, he's not there. Okay. I'm going to turn that off, and hopefully Kylie can connect to him and actually get him on in person.
Yeah, yeah, I'm working really hard on it.
Yeah, he's saying that sarcastically. All right, so as far as other stories going on, the other major story that we have not been on the air for is Twitter. What's going on with Elon Musk taking over Twitter? Any thoughts from you guys?
Yeah. I don't expect this to suddenly make Twitter as much fun again as it once was, but I know it's certainly making certain corners of it much more active, and that's maybe not such a great thing. I do note that it seems to be fueling a wave of renewed interest in Mastodon, the free, decentralized, open source, community owned and operated sort of Twitter clone, which you can get more information about at joinmastodon.org. And there have been people that I've known for a long time on Twitter who have sort of poked their nose into Mastodon and started looking around recently, looking for that social network experience, perhaps with a little less muskiness.
I was hoping you guys could talk a little longer while we're trying to connect to Alex.
we certainly could. The thing about this is it is another case of somebody with a whole lot of money centralizing that using that money to centralize power over a huge chunk of public discourse. You know, billionaires own the major news outlets. They own the major television outlets. They own the major radio outlets, and they own the major social media outlets online. You have Facebook. You have Instagram. You have Twitter. And you know, I don't personally find Elon Musk somebody who is particularly charming or trustworthy or even at all confidence inspiring in how he would run something like Twitter. So I don't know how much longer I'll be tweeting, but I know I'll probably stick around on Mastodon for a good long while because you can't buy it.
But Rob, why is it necessary that you like the person that owns it?
Because at the end of the day, when you use something, you're making them money. You are legitimizing their hold on it. And I don't know how much more of my crap posting and stupid jokes that I like Twitter for need to be increasing shareholder value for somebody who is actively making things worse.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure how much better it was doing before, you know. And you know, I think if I look at everything that I use and apply that scrutiny to it, I won't be using a whole lot. You know, because just about every major company out there is going to be run by people I detest. The thing is, can I get something that I want out of it? Will I be prevented from doing what I want to do? I don't really care. I don't really care who is running it or how they run it, as long as they're not doing really terrible, heinous things. But I don't really expect them to be the kind of person I'd want to hang out with at any time.
Emmanuel, the one other thing that seems to be thrown around here about this that I'm wondering about your feelings on is there seems to be scuttlebutt that he wants to bring the banned former president back onto the platform.
Yeah, that would be an issue for me. Definitely would be an issue. It's got nothing to do with censorship. It's got to do with hate speech, disruption, white supremacy, all that nonsense that apparently Twitter would then be embracing. That, to me, would be something that would be a problem, a huge problem. But, you know, just his personality or the things that he says, that's not enough there. But doing something that would completely turn Twitter into a cesspool again, that to me would be, it's time to look for something else. It's time to look for a replacement. Gila, go ahead.
Is it not? I mean, so if Elon Musk takes over Twitter, are they going to stop enforcing the terms of service? They're not really well enforced now, honestly. And whether he reinstates the former guy or not, there are a lot of usage cases where people report violations of the terms of service and are told, no, that's not really a violation of the terms of service. Mm-hmm. And just because you can have a username that calls for genocide or for violence against a group of people or genders or sexual identities or whatever it may be. So, okay, they're not enforcing the terms of service. They won't enforce the terms of service. I fail to see, I'm not thrilled, but I don't know if it's going to get worse necessarily. It's not great to begin with.
There's also something that I've really been missing about the social media experience in general. And, like, I love online social media. I've been using it since there's been such a thing, basically. I was on Usenet. I was on, you know, email lists. I was on LiveJournal. I was on MySpace, you know. And there was always this sense from the people, from the core crowd of people who enjoyed these things and gathered on them, that you were kind of always looking for the next thing. Like, okay, where are we going from this one when this one starts to suck? And there would always be that moment when the service you're using, like, loses touch with its users or changes the TOS or does some other boneheaded move that has the users going, okay, time to go somewhere else. Where are we all going next? And we would hop sort of from service to service. There'd always be something new that popped up that looked interesting, and some things would fail, some things would catch on, and you would go from place to place to place. And then Facebook came along and Twitter came along, and they stayed, and people, like, stopped moving. And it became sort of a general public thing, and a sort of all-pervasive, rich, powerful thing. And I think there's a lot that's been lost about that sort of spirit of just we're going to search for more, because we know that we can get more from this experience than this one centralized service is giving us. And I wonder if it's time that that sort of attitude came back about social media, that it didn't have to be a one thing that you were on forever.
I think maybe the problem is social media itself is unsustainable. You can't get everybody together. You can't share everything. You can't just display your personal life and expect it to be okay with the rest of the world, and they're going to respect your privacy and your thoughts and opinions and things like that. I think there's something inherently flawed in just doing that in the first place. And that's kind of why I've shied away from Facebook and these sites where everybody, you know, kind of displays everything they're doing. First of all, I'm not interested, and I'm not interested in sharing that information in the first place. I think it's a tremendous security issue for so many people that they don't realize. I mean, you know, it used to be that private eyes and detectives would have to investigate people. Now, you're doing it to yourself. You're basically giving all the evidence of where you live and where you go to school and where you work and where you've been. You're doing all their work for them. It's really, you know, kind of pathetic. I think, you know, there's still plenty of ways that people can communicate and express their opinions. But again, going back to what I was saying before, does it have to be you? Does it have to be your specific name, your specific address? Can you be somebody else? Like in the old BBS days, nobody cared who you really were. And that's what bothers me about what I hear Elon Musk saying, is that there's not going to be any more anonymity. I think anonymity is the key to being able to express yourself safely and securely. If everything is attached to a real person, first of all, it doesn't make the dialogue any more intelligent. You know, proof of that, look at newspapers that require you to be a real user, or Facebook that requires a real name. And you see plenty of people proudly using their real names and their real towns and saying the worst things possible. You know, they've been weaponized. They're not afraid anymore to express those thoughts. So I don't think anonymity is the issue at all. I think that is, in fact, possibly the salvation for, communications in the first place.
A big thing I think had an impact on some of those platforms staying is the previous ones that Rob was talking about were based on web pages and desktop computing. A lot of these newer platforms started going with people everywhere.
Because the mode that you're publishing things was in your pocket. It's in mobile form, and that completely changed the way people were using social media, and it stuck in ways that when you're sitting at a machine typing paragraphs of your on your web blog and carefully curating images, it just wholly changed when people are out having fun with their media generator at within reach and at their fingertips the whole time, you know, sharing their actual life. And I think we did romanticize that stuff way too much.
Mm-hmm.
Way too much. To a point where we have generations of people who think it's just dope to go and commit crimes while recording yourself and no one will care. Like, there are so many domestic violence and harassment and divorces and stuff. I mean, SMS is a admissible form of evidence these days. And people just think, like, you know, if I'm harassing someone or I'm stalking or if I'm out there, you know, generating hateful visual or other kinds of media and weaponizing it and using it on people in really hurtful and damaging ways, that no one's going to pay attention and it's just going to slide because of free speech or something. That is just so completely wrong. I'm not trying to say that, you know, people should get away with more and be more careful in their hatred. I'm just saying that there's this this feeling, that this sense of permission or just that, you know, whatever they do in their life is validated by their followers, so somehow society has to accept that behavior, no matter how hateful. And then, of course, quickly throwing up some banner of speech and then calling it good, in such the way that Mr. Musk's absolutist attitude sees it totally as, you know, society's fault for not saying more over the disgusting stuff. Well, I got news for you. There's a lot more of that ugly stuff out there, and it's not just bots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. That's
so
my point.
You put all the lovely, happy, or charged rebuttals and counterpoise, you're just going to get more of that hate, maybe tenfold.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is, I think, really misguided to convince yourself of that just because you have, you think you're an expert at everything and, mm-hmm. you know, you don't even know what your lane is, but
it's just very
somehow,
naive.
Somehow, yeah, that is, you're going to save us all.
It's just very naive because, you know, it's easy to say, oh, let's just let everybody speak and it'll work itself out. No, it's not that simple. It really is not that simple. And, you know, I've seen this attitude from people that really don't know what they're talking about, and to see it with somebody this powerful, oh, boy, it's going to be an interesting ride. You know, we've kind of given up on Alex because we tried reaching him. He wasn't picking up his phone, and I don't know if he's...
Hello, can you hear me now?
I hear something, but are you going to be there longer than 10 seconds?
I think he's in the bag.
Well, let's hope. Let's hope.
All right.
I'm in a better spot.
Doesn't Acela have Wi-Fi? I thought that was one of the selling points.
Well, it's not very consistent either.
Well, I'm glad you're here now because I wanted to bounce this off of you because this is a really important story that we saw in the 2 weeks that we weren't on. But basically, you were talking about Virgil Griffith, who was sentenced to 5 years in prison for going to North Korea and going to a cryptocurrency conference, et cetera, et cetera. Well, now, you know, it's gotten bigger. Yeah, it's gotten bigger in the last 2 weeks. The United States has issued an Interpol red notice against someone named Chris Ems for allegedly violating U.S. sanctions against North Korea. He's currently being held in Saudi Arabia. He's fighting U.S. extradition. Here's the thing. Chris Ems is not a U.S. citizen. He's from Reigate in Surrey in England. And basically, the United States has accused him of violating the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, despite not being a quote-unquote U.S. person and thus not subject to the legislation. This is crazy. This is insane. This shows you that once our government gets a taste of what it can pull off, and I'm thinking of Julian Assange as a good example of this, there's no stopping them, no stopping them at all. So basically, he's a blockchain expert, which makes him a threat right away. He's been a prominent speaker on regulatory issues and a broker and consultant for companies with blockchain and Web3. He went on to open the first ever kosher food distribution company in the Gulf, significantly investing in the region, giving him the opportunity to play a crucial role in the Abraham Accords. And that's why he was in that particular part of the world. Also attended the cryptocurrency conference in North Korea along with Virgil Griffith, who was a U.S. citizen, and others that he had not met until the first day of the conference. On the day of arrival, all attendees had their belongings rigorously searched, and basically I went through all of that. I don't know. This whole thing is really crazy. He spoke at the conference. He covered information that can be found freely on the Internet, which North Koreans have access to. We were even shown libraries where this information could be accessed, he recalls. He provided no information that could have helped the government evade U.S. sanctions against them, and no information that was secret nor unavailable on Google. But the important thing is he's not even a U.S. citizen. He's allowed to go to North Korea. He's a British citizen. He's not subject to these rules. How, and I hope we still have Alex, how does the United States get away with this?
Right, I'm here. Hopefully you guys can hear me. Can you hear me all
yes,
right?
Yes, we can. Talk quickly.
Okay. Yeah, coincidentally, by the way, Kyle, when you were trying to call me before, I picked up the wrong line. Another number was called. It wound up being Virgil. So Virgil, coincidentally, called me and wanted me to relay to everybody that he says hello, he's doing well, and he encourages people to read about the crypto wars in the 90s. He thinks there is an analog to what's happening today.
Wow.
It comes from Virgil, and that's why I didn't before, Kyle, because I picked up and Virgil was telling me that.
Okay.
So,
talk quickly, Alex, because we're running out of time.
With respect to these two new indictments, I mean, I don't want to speak too much about it, but I'll go into how they can be. It's all part of the crime that they allege involved Virgil, right? That there was essentially a conspiracy to violate the IEPA statute, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, by which North Korea was sanctioned, and that with those who were part of that conspiracy, Christopher Enns and the other person that was also indicted was a Spanish national by the name of Cal de Veros, who was also the subject of a BBC documentary called The Mole, which is quite an interesting documentary about the Korean Friendship Association of Cal de Veros. I'm sure our listeners can find it fascinating to watch that. But it's because it's all part of the same nexus of facts. But there are many issues, I think, as you rightly identify, Emmanuel, about whether or not those laws would apply to foreign nationals and whether they had notice of them. So that will undoubtedly be litigated after the extradition request is addressed in the courts in Saudi Arabia and potentially Spain as well. So this is definitely something that's going to unwind over the next few weeks or months, and we were going to be watching it with a very close eye.
Okay, and hopefully maybe we can talk about this a little bit more on Overtime, which is coming up at 8 o'clock on Channel 2600 on YouTube. Follow the link on the 2600.com page. And you can also write to us, OTH at 2600.com. And please support WBAI. Give to WBAI.org is the website, or call 212-209-2950. Pledge whatever you can afford to keep the station going. And again, another reminder, we have the EFF fundraiser going until Friday for anyone who buys a ticket to Hope. Hackers on Planet Earth, please send in your talk submissions and workshop submissions. We'll see you next week. Good night.
Captain, we are about to attempt a crash landing. Please extinguish all cigarettes. Place your tray tables in their upright top position. Your captain says, put your head on your knees. Head in your hands. Captain says, put your hands on your head. Put your hands on your hips. This is your captain. We are going down. We are all going down. Together. And I said, this is going to be some day. Thank you. feeling I've seen this all before. Why? I've got eyes in the back of my head.